KIOS FM presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 10th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by the Nebraska Humanities Council. This program was recorded on Wednesday, November 9th, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Juan Williams, Senior National Correspondent and News Analyst for National Public Radio, Political Analyst for the Fox News Network, and author of several books, including the nonfiction bestseller Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965. He'll talk about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman.
Joining the likes of fellow journalists and previous visitors, such as Tom Friedman and William Sapphire, is this year's presenter, Juan Williams. This year, our nation marks the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We are very privileged to have Mr. Williams join us to give this year's lecture focusing on the historical significance of that legislation and the civil rights movement. History shows us that the American democracy has been a work in progress, one that continues to evolve and that strives toward the ideal of that more perfect union laid out in the United States Constitution. We are perhaps more keenly aware of the long fight for civil rights with the passing of Rosa Parks, whose defiance 50 years ago marked a turning point in the struggle for equality in this nation. And our speaker tonight is one of America's leading authorities on these topics. Juan Williams has documented the struggle for civil rights in books such as his most recent work, My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, and Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary. In addition to his work as a biographer, historian, and author, Juan Williams has had a long and distinguished, probably honorable career as a journalist. He was a political analyst and national correspondent with the Washington Post for 21 years, serving as an editorial writer, op-ed columnist, and White House reporter. Williams has received several awards in journalism for his investigative reports and writing. Today, he is a respected political analyst for Fox Television. He tells me he's the balanced part of the fair and balanced network. Whatever your political persuasion, his deep understanding of history and diversity in this country, combined with his political expertise, make him an excellent choice to deliver this year's lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my high honor to present to you the balanced one of fair and balanced, Juan Williams.
Thank you. Well, good evening, and it's my great honor to be here for this 10th annual lecture. Governor, thank you for that delightful introduction. I appreciate it sincerely. You know, I guess I am the balanced part of fair and balanced, but it's a pleasure there to engage in debate about the key political issues of our day at Fox. Yesterday and today, I've met some of you who say you also know me as the voice on National Public Radio, and that it's good to put a face with the voice. You know, I always have to restrain myself when people say that to me, because the instinct in my heart is to say, you know, I didn't know what you looked like either. It's a surprise to me. But it's good to be with you. And I must say, good to be in Nebraska. Just terrific. Just had a wonderful day. And the weather, you know, it's not that bad. In Washington last week, Washington, D.C., we had a frost, and you had to pull in all the animals and the tomatoes and all the rest. As my wife said, it was so cold that some of the senators had to walk around with their hands in their own pockets. It was that cold. Just freezing. Tonight I wanted to focus on a time of change in our nation. I think all of us know about the tremendous change that's taking place in terms of the demographics of our country. But I think it's harder for us sometimes to take a step back and have a sense of how grand, how momentous this era is in terms of change. I speak here in specific of change in terms of civil rights and our understanding of equal rights in America. You know, when I wrote Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, I was focused on a period now 40 years old. I'm talking about the historic landmark Brown versus Board of Education of 1954. I'm talking about struggles that took place subsequently, ranging from Little Rock, Arkansas, and the desegregation of Central High School there with the Little Rock Nine, to the Great March on Washington of 1963, moving forward then to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the act that we commemorate here today, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And of course, those momentous occasions really engendered a wave of change in American society over subsequent years. If we're thinking in terms of the passage of the Voting Rights Act, we're also thinking about, well, you're thinking about President Johnson, the president who signed that act, saying at the time that this was really the death knell for Democratic control of Southern states, that Republicans would control the Southern states for the rest of his life and beyond. And of course, those words have been proven true. And you think as well of the growing political clout that came for African Americans, especially in our big cities. You think about the presence of big city mayors coming during the 1970s in cities ranging from Gary, Indiana, to Chicago, to Cleveland, New York, Los Angeles, Houston. I could go on. You come to understand the power that came with that political punch in terms of discussions and debate over everything from affirmative action to busing to contract set-asides. Our whole concept of civil rights and equality has been impacted by the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But to understand the magnitude of change as it continues to impact us today, I think it requires us to have a sense of where we are and who we are as Americans 40 years later in 2005. And that's why, as I begin, I say I think it's hard for people to have a sense today of how much change is taking place in American society. If you look back over the last 100 years or so, you can see a change in terms of our economic base in the society, for example. You could see that we have gone from being an agriculturally based nation, something you know well here in the state of Nebraska, to one that had an industrial base. And then subsequently we have gone forward and we have become a society that's gone through transitions to a service-based economy, an information-based economy, a high-tech economy, a biotech economy. And all of these changes have taken place in a shorter and shorter time span. We now have in our biotech society pills that will lower your cholesterol. We have pills that will grow hair on your head. We have pills, well, let me just say that if this speech lasts longer than 4 hours, you should seek immediate medical attention. Yes, the rate of change is upon us. And if you think about all of that change, you come to understand that how a nation handles change is absolutely critical. And the leadership that's available at the time of change oftentimes gives definition not only to who we are as Americans, but to generations to come in terms of their struggle to continue the American experiment. I think back to an era of change in the 1930s with President Roosevelt, and you think about his response to the Great Depression. You think about the establishment of Social Security. You think about child labor acts, about banking regulation. You think about his response to the idea of tyranny as it was faced and represented by the Nazis, the imperialists, and the fascists, and how that president, that American president, vowed to put the American people back to work to get us back on our feet. Or you think about the era of change that surrounded the passage of the 65 Voting Rights Act, and another president, President Johnson. President Johnson, who began the Great War on Poverty during that period, and during that period put in place Head Start, Medicare, Medicaid, model cities, grants for education. All of this was part of his effort, again, to deal with a time of tumult and change in American society. Today, we are in another era of change. Another era of change. And this time, the change has so much to do with race. So much to do with aging. So much to do with immigration. So much to do with the fact that we have become part of a global economic structure. This is a time of terrific change. And in order to share the magnitude of that change with you, I thought what I would do is take you on a trip that I took just a few years ago for National Public Radio. I was looking at the 2000 census reports and looking at changes that were occurring in America and decided that I wanted to see these changes firsthand. And the first stop that I made was to a place just outside of Washington, D.C., called Prince George's County, Maryland. I'll tell you why I went there. In 1975, Prince George's County was 80% white. Today, in 2005, Prince George's County is 60% black. Now, if I was to say to you that any jurisdiction, any neighborhood in America had gone from being 80% white to 60% black, well, the two of us might jump to a conclusion. We might assume that property values had decreased. We might assume that the level of educational attainment had gone down. We might assume that the level of average incomes in the community had also gone down. Well, if we brought 1975 preconceptions into 2005 and made those assumptions about Prince George's County, we would be absolutely wrong. Because in 2005, with a 60% black population, Prince George's County has seen that its property values have escalated. Not only that, the level of educational attainment has gone through the roof. And on top of that, the level of personal income has soared. Why? Because what was previously a community that was based on horse farms, produce farms, is now a suburban bedroom community for highly educated federal workers, largely based in Washington, D.C. And this community that in 1975 was known as a racially troubled community, one in which the blacks were typically farm hands and poorly educated and not participants in the political process, is now a community where you have a black school superintendent, a black chief of police, where you have a black county executive. The arguments that take place in the county are less about busing than they are about getting Nordstrom's and other brand name restaurants and department stores to come into the community and defeat the stereotypes to simply look at the data, the statistics that would indicate this is a prime market for the sale of their goods and services. This is part of a tremendous change that's being replicated throughout America. You can go into the suburbs of New York, Houston, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Seattle, and you can see not just larger than ever, historically large, groups of middle-class black Americans, but you can see politically and economically powerful groups of Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, immigrants from around the world that simply didn't exist as part of the American family 25 years ago. This is part, again, of a shifting demographic that has now more than 30% of the American people as people of color, and people of color with power, as opposed to people of color who feel marginalized or set aside in the American family. The second stop I made on my trip was Austin, Texas. And I went to Austin because I was so fascinated with the idea that Austin is the home of Dell Computers. And Dell Computers has brought new money into this small state capital of Austin, Texas. Austin is not only the state capital, but home to the University of Texas. It's known as a kind of funky music town, a place where the politicians go and party and the college students go and party. It was always a party town. But now, with the presence of Dell, to my eyes, I thought, isn't this wonderful? You're going to have people there absolutely ecstatic at the notion that there's an infusion of new dollars, new economic security, new job opportunities. This is really what all of America would wish for, would dream for, that there would be a Dell in their midst. So you can imagine my surprise when I arrive and begin to do some reporting, talking to people, and discover that people oftentimes have, well, bitter feelings. Sometimes they refer to the people who work at Dell as the Dellionaires, because, of course, so many of them have become millionaires. Not only that, if you're talking to the people who are school teachers, the people who are nurses, the people who are the policemen, they talk about how the newcomers in this high-tech economic sector oftentimes build their own mini mansions, have their own police forces. They don't really take part in the community's pools or schools, that they are quite separate and elitist. And it's so interesting that as you go across the river into the east side of town where the blacks and the Hispanics have lived for generations, they talk about having their children in schools that are not identified by the high-tech companies and the dot-coms as a resource for developing the future workers, the people who will make their companies go forward in the future. To the contrary, they feel that those schools and those children are ignored. And I might add, the people on the east side of Austin speak with some resentment about the presence of so many immigrants in their midst. Because if you understand a community like Austin, you can see that it is being rapidly changed by an influx not only of dollars, but new faces. Faces that come from Asia, come from Latin America, come from the newly independent republics of Eastern Europe, brought here not under visa programs built to reunify families, but visa programs purposely intended to bring the very brightest people in the high-tech sector to the United States to keep those high-tech firms humming at the cutting edge of innovation. So what that means in Austin is you get communities of Chinese, of Vietnamese, you get communities of Argentinians, you get communities from all over the world. And to the people on the east side of the river, people who have been here for generations, though they may be Hispanic, people who are black and who have been here for generations, they look at these newcomers who are oftentimes participating in that global economy. And they say, you know, these people have no sense of our history as Americans and the struggle, the civil rights struggle to attain equal rights. In fact, they look down on us and think that we are ill-educated, and somehow lesser because we're not fully participating in that high-tech economy. I think it's worthwhile to stop here for a moment and realize how much immigration is going on at this moment in America. It's hard, if you look back in history, to see anything comparable to this moment. If you went back to the start of the last century, to the start of the 20th century, you would see something comparable in terms of percentages of immigrants coming to the United States. But of course, we're a much bigger country now. So in absolute numbers, there's never been anything like the rush of immigrants to these shores as it's taking place today. And the immigrants who were coming to these shores 100 years ago were people who were coming from Germany, from Ireland, from Italy, from Great Britain. They were coming to the big cities up and down the East Coast with the hope that their children would one day come out west, come to Nebraska, come for opportunity. Today, the immigrants that are coming from, well, as we saw in Austin, they're coming from Asia. They're coming from Latin America, the Caribbean, from Africa, from those newly independent European republics. They're coming here oftentimes speaking a different language and hoping to not only retain the language, but maybe to go back home. They send money back home. They see America as simply part of a global structure in terms of economic and educational opportunities. This has led them to be called by some the hyphenated Americans. And of course, part of this picture is also illegal immigration. Illegal immigration that has threatened so many in terms of low-income service sector jobs and employment. That adds to the numbers in terms of the immigrant picture in America in 2005 and makes it part, a necessary part of our understanding of what civil rights means and what the civil rights struggle entails in 2005. It's truly a challenge. The demographers, in fact, have given up on the idea so central to our understanding of immigration, that America, for most of its history, has been a melting pot. In place of that vision of all of us coming together and becoming part of one great stew, the demographers now speak about a salad bowl in which the lettuce and the tomatoes and the carrots all retain their separate identities, but nonetheless work together to create a nutritious salad. You can think of me as a kind of skinny, fuzzy-headed carrot standing up here, you know, looking for cute tomatoes or something like that. But that picture would suggest that we are no longer about making everyone into an American, that assimilation, which was, of course, key to the American experience for most of our history, is now a controversial topic for so many who insist on their right to retain their sense of nationalism, their language, their prerogative to go back home, instead of the promise that their children would become fully American. This is a challenge to our identity in this time. The next stop I made on this trip was in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And the reason I went there was because I couldn't believe it when I saw that the 2000 census indicated that already a quarter of the American population is under the age of 18. I had no idea that America was such a young country. And I wanted to talk to someone who was part of this generation, wanted to talk to people who were going through the experience of being young people in America today. I might add that several people who I expressed my surprise to said to me, you know, Juan, if you've been in a mall lately, if you've seen the Gap stores, the Abercrombie and Fitch's and Navy and all these stores, you know, who do you think they're selling goods to? They're selling goods to teenagers who have their hands in mom's pocketbook or dad's back pocket. If you go to the movies, you look at a movie like Titanic, which should have been about a ship hitting an iceberg, and instead you have Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet kissing and falling in love, you have an idea as to who these directors are aiming their movie at. It's young people. That's the big audience. That's the mass market. Well, off I go to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm in this high school, and I run into a woman who was a counselor. She had attended this high school, Washburn High School, in the 1960s, sent her children there in the 1980s, and now, as I say, was working as a counselor at Washburn High. Now, Washburn High, between the 1960s and the 2005, of course, is a radically different place. You have a large community, not only of African Americans and Hispanics now as part of the high school, but you also have Hmong, you have Somalis, you have people from all over the world represented in a school that in 1960 was almost totally homogeneous and white. So when I said to this woman, I said, "What's the big change in Washburn High?" I expected that she was going to talk to me about race. Instead, she said, "Juan, I notice you've been talking to the students here. You've sought out the student leaders, the best students, the best athletes." She asked if I noticed anything, and I was slow on the pickup. She said, "Well, if you'd sought out the best athletes and the best students and the student leaders in the 1960s, you would have been talking to young men." And then it hit me that the top student, the valedictorian, was a young woman. The student body president was a young woman. Most of the athletes being recruited for Division I schools because of Title IX and its impact were young women. Young women had become the model of excellence at this high school. She went on to point out to me that if I looked at America's colleges and graduate schools, I would see that, in fact, they are dominated now by young women. I think the only exception is graduate schools of engineering. Women at Washburn High are the ones who are invited back to act as role models for students. She said when they deal with issues of educational problems, most often what they're talking about is reaching out to the young men. And here she stopped and made a specific point of talking about problems impacting young minority men, especially the Hispanic population, but also young black men. High dropout rates, a tremendous achievement gap in terms of scores and performance in the classroom. These are problems, she said, that continue to dog Washburn High. But she said when it comes to young women, without regard to the color of their skin, the young women are overachievers. I'll tell you the last stop I made on this trip. I went down to Orlando, Florida, because according to the Census Bureau, Orlando, Florida, in fact, the state of Florida, is one of the few places in America with a population that already over 20% of the population is past the age of 65. I understand from some of my friends here in Nebraska that you have many senior citizens here as well. But in the case of the state of Florida, the census speculates, I suppose, that pretty soon, probably about 2020, 2025, the entire state will have a population of people over the age of 65 that exceeds 25%. It will be a moment, a barrier breaker in terms of that phenomenon in American life. So I went to Central Florida, to Orlando, to see what it means to be over the age of 65 today. Now, I must tell any of you, and the governor probably knows this well, that whenever a reporter shows up at your doorstep, the reporter shows up with preconceptions, an idea of what the story is before you even open your mouth. And in my case, what I had in mind was, my goodness, these are folks who've gotten the gold watch. You know, they're a step from the grave. I hope I can make this an interesting story. So as I'm approaching the Senior Citizen Center where I've set up some interviews, I hear the most raucous, loud rock and roll music playing. And I say to the people who are with me, my engineers and technicians, I say, gosh, I wonder if this is like disrupting these old people from their naps. Well, what a surprise when I get into the courtyard and the band is made up of elderly people. And I said to the woman who greeted me, gosh, what a surprise, they're playing, you know, hard rock. And she said, Juan, she said, this is 2 years ago. She said, do you know what the top grossing rock and roll act on tour was last summer? I said, I had no idea. She said, well, it was someone who was over the age of 65. I said, oh, who was that? And she said, Tina Turner. I thought, great legs, over 65. That's unbelievable. But, you know, you stop and think about it this summer, you think about people like Mick Jagger and Rod Stewart. I mean, it's a whole different concept of, you know, the rock and roll generation. I then made a stop inside, and one of the people who greeted me was the travel counselor. And the travel counselor announced to me that after 9/11, if it wasn't for the senior citizens, she said the American travel industry would have absolutely gone in the tank. She said the seniors were the first people who got on the airplanes, got back on the cruise ships, people who wanted to get out, were willing to take a risk, but intent on the idea of still exploring the world. And wouldn't you know it, there were two or three universities that had satellite offices there because so many of these over 65 people were engaged in going back to school, desirous of attending lectures, interested in all manner of intellectual stimulation. It was an age cohort that also had a lot of money. So you saw that these folks were oftentimes joining together to create investment clubs. In some cases, these people were entrepreneurs. In many cases, these were people who were continuing to work as consultants for companies where they had previously been employed and now would go in only on special assignment. This is a different kind of over 65. It wasn't what I had expected in any way. And in terms of their political power, oh my goodness, these are people who gave money to political candidates, people who voted, people who were very much aware. They read the daily paper, they watched the cable news discussions. They're active. And their issues, I think their issues are on the front page every day in terms of Social Security, in terms of making sure that prescription drugs are more available, not as expensive, in terms of preserving the idea of high-quality medical care and medical care facilities, which increasingly are becoming a part of the key to economics in so many communities now, these large health centers, medical centers. So I quickly came to understand that what the future holds in terms of being over 65 in America is a new group of Americans with high energy, a good amount of money, and a tremendous intellectual edge to them that's going to redefine again what it means to be elderly in America. You should know that the AARP already has a 2011 council. 2011 is the year in which the first of the baby boomers will turn age 65, and after that, it's like going over a waterfall. There's so many people who are going to be coming into that pool. But being the reporter that I am, I thought, I truly can't understand the impact of this over 65 generation unless I talk to the people who live with them. So I went out to talk to the mayor, to the county executive, to people who live in Orlando, Florida, with this older generation. And it was so interesting to hear them say, well, you know, these older folks may be caring and invested in Social Security and lowering the cost of prescription drugs, but when it comes to our public schools, their children, their grandchildren aren't in those schools. And when it comes to economic development in our community, their attitude tends to be, well, I wish they'd close the door on Florida after I arrive. They don't want anyone else coming. They don't want much more in the way of economic development. They wish Disney would shut its doors instead of always threatening to expand. if we have a graying of Florida, there's also a concomitant browning of Florida as you have an influx of people coming up from Latin America attracted by the economic opportunity presented by Disney and by serving that elderly population. And that population, that younger, browner population, is intent on economic development, intent on the opportunities that come from a good school system, and finding themselves increasingly in conflict with the older folks. For example, when it came to a referendum on increasing the size of the highways and building mass transit, the political power of that older generation shut it down, said no, viewed it as a tax increase and a waste of money. To the younger people, the older folks can be driving along with their tickers going click, click, click on the left-hand side forever and ever, but not believe in the necessity of building additional lanes to hold the traffic coming in and out of town. You know, for people in my business in the media, it might be easy to look at that dynamic and identify it as a racial divide between an older white generation and a younger generation of people of color. But you know, I see it as a generational divide, much more than a racial divide. But it requires people, again, to have new eyes for old problems. I mention all of these stops to you because I think it's important for you to have a sense of where you are in 2005 and the challenges that face us and how we understand race and how we understand class and how we understand difference in American society today, whether that difference be over immigration, over the aging process, or over the tremendous success of our young women in schools and the problems that are impacting our younger people, especially our young men, and problems that continue to impact younger people, especially those in our big city public schools. I think it's absolutely critical that each and every one of us, in terms of exercising a vision of what might be, what can be, that each and every one of us, before we put our hands in the muck and mire of American life, before we raise our voices, understand what's truly at stake as we try and try our best to keep up the tradition of an America where people are working as family to solve problems. When I wrote Eyes on the Prize, I had the opportunity to travel around the country on a book tour. As the governor mentioned, Eyes on the Prize was accompanied by a 6-part TV series on public broadcasting, and there was a great deal of attention to it. And I would run into people all the time who would tell me that they were in high school or college in the 50s and 60s, and then would say to me they had no idea that people would be writing books, creating documentaries about that period, calling it the greatest social movement in American history. That at the time they were preoccupied with the football games, basketball games, with that handsome young man or that beautiful young woman. Some of them said they had pimples. They were worried about their pimples, whatever. And then they would say, occasionally their mother or father would say, don't worry about all those headlines in the paper about racial issues and changes going on in America. It's something happening in some distant big city or down the street, not in our neighborhood. Don't worry, it won't affect you, my darling. And they say today, when they look back on that, they just can't believe what a tremendous change has taken place in America. Well, I tend to be rather polite, and we shake hands and move on. But when I get back home, I always think to myself, you know, I don't think those people were even talking to me. I think they were really talking to themselves about being filled with regret at not having used their God-given power to make a difference at a time when they could have made such a critical difference in American life, when they could have put their hands into all of the clay, if you will, of American life and helped to shape what was to come. And instead, now they find themselves wistful about the fact that they let history pass right by them. Today, today I would suggest to you that it's key that all of us have a key understanding, a keen understanding of where we are, so that it's never the case that if you come, let's say, to the 25th Governor's Humanities Lecture, that there wouldn't be someone standing here who would ask each and every one of you if you understood the tremendous nature of change that was taking place in Nebraska and in the United States and around the globe at the start of the new century. That you wouldn't ever be so cursed as to say, well, I was preoccupied, I didn't quite grasp the enormity of the rapid changes that were impacting my community, my state, and my nation. That you didn't have a sense of how to put your hands in the clay and shape what was to come. Because today, we have a clear vision of these tremendous forces at work on America. And the challenge is how we manage that change. We can already see strains and tears in the American fabric over issues ranging from Social Security to immigration, and in specific to illegal immigration. We can already see tears and strains when it comes to how young people are handled and questions about our educational structure and educational system, and whether or not the funding is equitable for education in this society. We can already see tremendous stress and strain when it comes to a hurricane like Katrina, and suddenly to all the world, see who gets left behind and see that there's so many poor people, and in specific, so many poor black people, not only without cars, but without a hope in the midst of tremendous crisis. Remember back in the 1960s when Michael Harrington wrote his book, The Other American, and talked about poverty and got the entire country stirred up about the issue of hidden poverty, whether it was in Appalachia or in the Deep South or hidden in our big cities. And this year, we've seen that again, that moment arrive in terms of Katrina. But whether or not we truly respond and use it as a platform, a springboard to achieve change and to address that poverty issue is one that's yet to be determined, and again presents us with an opportunity, if we can see ourselves and our nation clearly, presents us with an opportunity to manage change, to be an engineer of social change. That is what is required in this time of each and every one of us. I wrote a book about former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. And as a young man, Marshall was not one who had much in the way of political consciousness. He was pretty much a middle-class black kid from Baltimore City. But after he graduated from Howard University Law School, because he could not gain admission to the University of Maryland Law School because they wouldn't admit people of color, after he graduated from Howard, the dean of his law school took him on a trip down south, and they were looking at the disparate conditions of schools available to black children and schools available to white children. The idea was that they were going to build up a record that could act as the basis for a lawsuit that would challenge the idea that separate but equal was constitutional. They were going to show that there was no separate but equal, that in fact, the reality was separate and unequal schools. Marshall and this law school dean, whose name was Charles Hamilton Houston, stopped at a school. I hesitate here because I don't think of it as a building. And when I say school, you think of a school building, I'm sure, but I mean, this was a shack, four wooden walls, deep down into Mississippi, almost to the Louisiana state line. And this shack, these four wooden walls with simple tar paper pulled over the top and no carpet, no floor, just dirt. And when the rains would come, the floors would become thick with mud. This was the school for the children of the black tenant farmers, the sharecroppers. And Houston went inside and was taking pictures and notes, and outside, Thurgood Marshall was standing there eating a sandwich, because these were two black men traveling through the South in the summer of 1935. They couldn't be assured that they would be welcomed in any hotels or restaurants, so they had bags of food on the back seat and pillows and blankets in the car, all the rest. And so here they are now down in this small town in the Delta. Houston's inside this shack of a school building, and Thurgood Marshall's outside eating a sandwich. And this little boy approaches, and the little boy stares at Thurgood Marshall. Doesn't say a word. He's mute. Thurgood Marshall's sort of amused. He thinks, oh, this kid's never seen anyone like me because, you know, he's freshly graduated from law school. He's quite full of himself. He thinks this kid's never seen a black man like me standing next to a car, college, law school graduate. But he soon realizes that the child's not even staring at him. Instead, the child is staring at an orange that Marshall has pulled out of a bag and put on the hood of the car, saving it for his dessert after he finishes the sandwich. Marshall thinks, well, do you want the orange? Go ahead, you can have it. The kid still doesn't say a word. Marshall grows impatient with the child and picks up the orange and says, go ahead, eat it. You can have it, eat it. And the kid, for the first time, responding, says, oh, eat it, and takes it and bites at it right through the rind. Thurgood Marshall looks at him and like, what are you doing? And then the kid, as if responding to the bitter taste of the rind, pulls it out of his mouth. And as he does so, the orange goes spraying all over his cheeks. Some of it drips onto his chin, gets all over his chest. Worse, some of it gets in his eyes and stings his eyes. And now the child starts to cry and takes the orange and throws it away, throws it, splatters it on the ground. Thurgood Marshall can't believe that this child has just wasted his orange. He starts screaming, what the hell is wrong with you, kid? What the hell? What are you doing? Why'd you do that with my orange? And the dean, who's been inside this school, suddenly hears all this screaming and crying and commotion. His first thought is, oh my God, some crazy segregationist is attacking young Thurgood. He comes running out, only to discover that Thurgood Marshall, this 6'4" young law student, is screaming at this little boy, this 8-year-old. And he says, Thurgood, what's going on? Why are you screaming at this child? Thurgood Marshall says, Dean, wait a minute, you don't understand. This kid took my orange, bit at it right through the rind like he's a crazy person, and now he's taken it, spit it out, and splattered it on the ground. Wasted my orange. Dean Houston looked at him and said, you know, Thurgood, I signed your law degree, but I don't think you understand what's going on here. He said, you know, these roads we've been traveling up and down, have you noticed that we don't see any office buildings, we don't see any factories? That the people around here, they're lucky if they can get the man in the big house to give them a piece of land in which they can be sharecroppers. That's economic opportunity around here. And then he said, you notice when someone's kind enough to invite us into their house at night for a meal, if we ask to use the bathroom, they tell us to go out back and use the outhouse, and we have to be careful where we step because they've got open troughs right there filled with human waste. He says, you know why that is, Thurgood? That's because they don't have any plumbing. They don't have any electricity. And when it comes to educating the next generation in this community, here he turned to this shack behind them. He said, this is what they have to offer their children, Thurgood. The teacher doesn't even have a blackboard. She's using a piece of charcoal to scrawl on the walls of this wooden shack. And now you're going to stand here and you're going to scream at this little boy because he doesn't know anything about peeling an orange, about slicing an orange, about picking the seeds out of an orange. He said, damn it, Thurgood, the kid's probably never seen an orange, much less eaten an orange. And you're doing nothing but embarrassing yourself and humiliating this child. Thurgood Marshall, this young law school graduate, could not believe what the dean had just said to him. It was inconceivable to him that there was any child in America who had never eaten an orange, that an orange could be such a precious commodity. That night, he writes home to his mother, dear mom, I went to law school to make you proud, to wear a suit and tie, to be lawyer marshal, to make some money. And when Dean Houston used to say to us during law school that a lawyer is nothing but a social parasite if a lawyer is not an engineer, I didn't understand him. But today I met a child who didn't know what an orange was. And I thought there should be somebody who stands up and represents that child somebody who's a voice for that child in American life. And that moment in Thurgood Marshall's life was an eye-opener. It was the moment at which his political consciousness evolved to the brink, took him to the moment where he said that his life could have meaning if it had a mission of raising the standards of understanding the plight of that child as the plight of all Americans, not just black Americans, not just poor Americans, but as a representation of a failure to achieve the American ideal of equal opportunity for all. And tonight, as we gather here in Omaha, as we gather to celebrate the humanities, we have to have a sense of the purpose of the humanities. The purpose of the humanities to allow us to truly understand the lives of others, to have a sense of the broader purpose of our own life, to reach inside of us in terms of our conscience, as we look to what America is becoming and try to have a clear sense of what America can be. That America can be even a greater, more prosperous, more just society if we have a clear understanding of who we are and the struggles that are necessary in order to achieve justice for the years to come. You know, when I finished writing Eyes on the Prize, I guess the most frequent question that I would get from people was a pretty straightforward question. They'd say, Juan, why would you call a book about the American Civil Rights Movement Eyes on the Prize? And I would joke with them that they didn't go into too many Baptist churches before I told them that the title comes from an old gospel song. And the song goes something like, keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on. I know the one thing I did right was the day I started to fight, hold on. And what I'm saying to all of you tonight is as we come together to celebrate the humanities, as we come together in 2005 to look back on the 1965 Voting Rights Act, as we look back on the 64 Civil Rights Act or on the Brown decision, or as the governor mentioned, looked back on the passing of Rosa Parks and what it meant in terms of Rosa Parks' activism to the larger nonviolent civil rights struggle when she refused to give up her seat on the bus. We look back on those events and we look back on the significance of those events, not just to say that we are informed, intellectual people, but to say that we now have inspiration for how we might act in our time to make a difference. That's why I don't think it's an option for us to simply watch the cable news shows and watch Britt Hume and I go at it. I don't think it's a comfort for us to turn on our favorite talk radio show in the morning, afternoon, or at night and say, oh my gosh, I'm glad someone's finally telling them what I want them to hear. I think this is a moment when we have an opportunity to really take off the jackets, to kick off the high heels, and to stick our hands into the clay of modern American life and work to shape and mold that future. But we have to do so with a clear mind, a clear conscience, and with our eyes on the prize. Thank you very much.
To begin, I want to first thank you for your talk, and I'm interested to know, based on your comments, to what degree do you think that possible the next movement in terms of civil rights or labor rights might be among this immigrant population that you spoke so much about, particularly in terms of America's growing diversity?
Well, I think that there is already a terrific change in terms of the composition of our country. If you think about the fact that African Americans are no longer even the major minority, so to speak, in our society. One of the tremendous efforts that's being made by the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., is a specific and targeted outreach to that Hispanic community because of the increasing power of that Hispanic vote. But I don't think that power exists at the moment in sufficient size that would give them political clout necessary. I suspect that when you see the arguments that are forming over illegal immigration, over the actions of groups like the Minutemen on our borders, questions about how we should allow for immigration reform, illegal immigration reform, I think that's the next step in terms of how we properly and fairly treat the immigrant community. I think that's the next movement. And I think already you can see people ranging from President Bush to Senator McCain and Senator Kennedy at the forefront of trying to shape that next epoch, that next era of immigration reform. I think that's where we're seeing it. But this larger issue, I would suggest, is not one that's going to be limited to our political process, that in fact it's impacted to a large extent by the tremendous shifts that we see of people coming from around the world and the attitudes they bring with them in terms of what it means to be an American. In recent days, we've seen the consequences of a lack of forethought on the part of the French people in terms of their handling of immigrant populations and making sure that that immigrant population was properly a part of their larger society. And now you have fear throughout much of Europe over the question of whether or not those immigrant populations have been fairly treated and properly assimilated. And I might add there's an added edge to it because so many of them are Arab and Muslim. Well, those issues exist for us as well in different forms with different populations. But they are all here, and again, I think they form a civil rights crisis of a different type than we could have imagined 40 or 50 years ago. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the 10th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by the Nebraska Humanities Council. Today's guest speaker has been Juan Williams, Senior National Correspondent and News Analyst for National Public Radio, Political Analyst for the Fox News Network, and author of several books, including the nonfiction bestseller Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965. He spoke about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This program was recorded on Wednesday, November 9, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane Hood, Executive Director of the Nebraska Humanities Council, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.